Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Claire McDonnell, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 11th of September, these are our main stories. President Trump has sacked his third national security adviser in 3 years. Benjamin Netanyahu says he will extend Israeli sovereignty over the Jordan Valley in the West Bank if he's re-elected. And the British cricketer whose knighthood is causing a storm. Also in this podcast...
The CEO of Estee Lauder said that 75% of the business's marketing budget was now going into influencer platforms.
From teenage YouTubers to mummy bloggers, why influencers are getting paid over $1 million per post and why they're here to stay. They disagreed about major foreign policy issues for quite some time, most notably about North Korea, Russia and Afghanistan. And now President Trump has sacked his national security adviser, John Bolton. The man, called a hawk by Trump, had taken a dim view on some of the president's approaches. The final straw is thought to have been Mr. Bolton's criticism of a planned meeting last Sunday between Mr. Trump and the Taliban. At a press briefing, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, said he'd also clashed with Mr. Bolton.
We all give our candid opinions. There were many times Ambassador Bolton and I disagree, that's to be sure. But that's true for lots of people with whom I interact. My mission set is always to make sure as I run the Department of State is to deliver America's diplomacy.
Well, I spoke to our correspondent in Washington, Tara McKelvey, about the reasons behind this split.
They certainly had differences in philosophies about these issues, just as you had mentioned. They saw the world in very different terms, and they often argued about these conflicts. Mr. Trump always wanted to sit down and negotiate and talk things out with people. And Mr. Bolton was deeply suspicious of the leaders in these countries. Once over in the National Security Council offices, I asked Mr. Bolton about his relationship with the president, and he just laughed loud and long. And clearly there was a lot of tension. And it wasn't just tension between him and the president. Mr. Bolton also had problems with other members of the administration. And that certainly contributed to his ouster. And here's the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, talking about the relationship.
I know everyone's talked about this for an awfully long time. There were definitely places that Ambassador and I, Bolton and I, had different views about how we should proceed.
So, Tara, what impact will this have on American foreign policy? Because one of the issues they seemed to disagree on was this U.S.-Afghanistan-Taliban talk that was supposed to happen at Camp David. Will that now be back on track?
Well, that's a good question. There's no doubt that the impact is huge. Mr. Trump says that next week he's likely to appoint a new national security advisor or an acting advisor. And chances are the new advisor will be much more in line with the president's views. Mr. Trump has campaigned on this idea that he would bring U.S. troops home from Afghanistan. He's fought very hard to do that. And Mr. Bolton was somewhat reluctant. Now, if you look at the polls, 59% of people in this country think that the U.S. should not play the role that it does now. They want the troops to come home. So it's very likely that the next national security advisor will reflect the president's views and that U.S. foreign policy will go in a different direction.
And do we have a temporary person in that position at the moment this evening?
Yes, we do. For a while at the White House, for a couple of hours, they weren't even able to say who that acting director is. His name is Charles Cooperman. He's a deputy in the National Security Staff, and he'll be in that role until Mr. Trump says who's going to be the official acting director or perhaps the new National Security Advisor.
Tara McKelvey. In a week's time, Israel heads to the polls for the second election this year. Opinion polls suggest it will be close. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his right-wing Likud party are facing a tough challenge from the centrist Blue and White Party. On Tuesday, Mr. Netanyahu said that if he were re-elected, he would extend Israeli sovereignty over the Jordan Valley and the northern Dead Sea. In other words, the eastern strip of the West Bank, which Israel has occupied since the war of 1967. The Palestinians claim the whole of the West Bank as part of any future state. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Tom Bateman, spoke to Tim Franks about how this could work.
Well, I think in two ways. I mean, politically, and you've alluded to this in the fact that this is the second election campaign this year, Mr. Netanyahu is doing everything he can to shore up the right-wing vote, to claw away at the votes of the settler movement, those in the right that believe in what they see as the greater Israel project, that Israel should be in the West Bank. And the appeal there is to say to those people, if you vote for me, if you vote for Likud, that he will apply Israeli sovereignty to that very significant and strategic part of the West Bank. But, of course, more significantly, I suppose, in the history of the conflict, this is the most detailed and specific pledge around extending Israeli sovereignty to any part of the West Bank that we've had since 1967. And so it is a very significant move if it comes to pass. It should be noted that he said the Israeli sovereignty wouldn't extend to areas within the Jordan Valley where there is a Palestinian population, so most notably the city of Jericho. So this isn't a kind of full annexation across the territory, but it applies Israeli law to the whole area except to Palestinian citizens. And that is part of the reason why I think this will receive much international condemnation. And already, of course, the Palestinians have said this would amount to a war crime.
Just briefly, Tom, though, we're expecting the US, much long-awaited US peace plan shortly after the Israeli general election. Presumably, Mr. Netanyahu wouldn't do this if he thought that peace plan was going to contradict him over this.
Yeah, well, that's the fundamental context to this. And what he significantly revealed as well was that that peace plan would come in the days after the election. Now, he said that it would contain what he described as challenges and opportunities, meaning for Israelis. So this, I think, will be seen as giving a concession to those people he wants to vote for him, in, you know, those people who will say, well, look, if we have to give away territory that we eventually want, then here's something that will still encourage them to vote for Mr. Netanyahu. But I think it's going to make, of course, for a fairly dramatic time in the days and weeks after the election.
Tom Bateman. Investing $1.8 trillion over the next decade in measures to adapt to climate change could produce benefits worth more than $7 trillion. That's the conclusion of the first report by the UN's Global Commission on Adaptation. It's calling for countries to take urgent action to mitigate the effects of extreme weather events. The report is all about how we can and must change the way we live to adapt to changes that are already happening. Andrew Steer is a member of the Commission and the CEO of the World Resources Institute and spoke to James Kumarasamy about the thinking behind the report.
Well, we first of all, of course, have to try and stop climate change. But, of course, climate change is already here, and so we need to adapt. We need to get used to the fact that already temperatures have risen by 1 degree Celsius, and that already is hurting 500 million small farmers around the world. It's threatening a billion people in coastal areas. We just saw this week, tragically, the Hurricane Dorian. Science predicts that extreme weather events will get more intense, and they certainly are. So we have to both aim to stop climate change getting worse, but we need to work much, much harder to adapt to that climate change.
Where should the priority be? If we stop, we don't need to adapt, surely.
Well, if we could stop, we wouldn't need to adapt. But unfortunately, it's already happening. And even if we were to cut all greenhouse gas emissions to zero right away, still in many decades to come, things will get worse. The scientists are almost unanimous on that. So this is not a choice of trying to stop climate change or trying to adapt. Unfortunately, we need to do both. In terms of where we start, we need to ask the question, who is being most affected? And of course, it's a moral imperative as well as an environmental and an economic imperative. Those that did least cause the problem are those that are most threatened. And so agriculture in Africa, poor farmers, up to 30% declines in their yields are likely to happen. Where insects used to die out over winter, just a 1 degree increase in Celsius temperature means they now live through the winter, and then they wreak havoc, of course, because they multiply.
So what are the key types of adaptation that you're calling for?
Well, the important thing is to really sort of change the mindset. For the last 100 years, as we've been doing modern planning, we've assumed that the past trends are a good predictor of the future. And unfortunately, that's no longer the case. So we really need to assume that the future is not only going to become more difficult, but actually more unpredictable. So whether you are a mayor of a city or a prime minister of a country or a village leader in Bangladesh, you still need to be thinking about the future, and you need to ask the question, who's most affected? And so there are some very simple things that are happening. Crops are being changed. So in Costa Rica, they're producing somewhat less coffee, more oranges. In Bangladesh, some very simple things. Instead of chickens, they're now, some farmers are investing in ducks because they can swim. So very, very simple things. But then at the other end of the spectrum, massively sophisticated things. So the Thames Barrier, for example, has lowered risk, which has enabled the financial district in the east of London to grow up. And so we both have the relatively simple at one level to the highly sophisticated. And we need a really comprehensive approach.
Andrew Steer, a member of the UN's Global Commission on Adaptation and the CEO of the World Resources Institute. Now, social media influencers are a major part of the modern advertising world. In fact, online influencers are expected to be a $10 billion industry by 2020. In total, brands are paying them billions to promote their products. The American reality star Kylie Jenner was recently paid around $1.2 million for a single post on Instagram. But can this growth be sustained? Ben Bland has been speaking to Sarah McCorkadale, CEO of Cork, an analysis firm and author of the book Influence, about a young industry that's taking over big business.
Brands are putting more and more money into influencer channels when it comes to marketing. Only last month, the CEO of Estee Lauder said that 75% of the business's marketing budget was now going into influencer platforms.
But it's effective because at one point it was very sort of subtle. People felt they were picking up style ideas or product ideas from people they looked up to. Increasingly, people are aware that a lot of these posts are sponsored, the products are given for free, or the influencers are paid to promote them. As the cynicism grows around the authenticity, does that mean the industry will change quite more dramatically?
Absolutely. I think that we have not hit upon an effective way to commercialise influencer platforms at this point. Certainly, the aggressive commercialisation of Instagram has caused a real friction between influencers and their audiences. And what we're seeing more of now is influencers' audiences are actually, you know, talking back to them and saying, please stop selling me things. Mm. Because the reason they follow them is because they are compelled by their story.
With the influencers, presumably, it's a limited, it's almost like, you know, being a top flight footballer, limited shelf life. You have to make as much as you can because eventually, you know, the firms won't be interested anymore.
Well, some have short-term goals and they're in it for the moment to make as much money as they can within perhaps, you know, a period of 5 years. Others have used social media incredibly effectively to springboard businesses. You know, they have their own product lines. They're working in traditional media. I believe the future of this is, you know, in 5 years' time, influencers will just be another part of the media rather than this kind of unexplainable phenomenon the way that it's viewed just now.
Ben Bland talking to author and marketing expert Sarah McCorkadale. Still to come in this podcast.
I saw for the first time the way blacks were treated. But it didn't make me hate America. It made me understand how people can be.
We learn more about the photographer Robert Frank, called a revolutionary for his work capturing ordinary people. He's died at the age of 94. A British man has lost £30,000, that's $37,000, of his life savings. He was trying to avoid a speeding fine worth just $125. Richard Keedwell claims he was wrongly clocked doing 5 miles an hour over the limit. In court, he tried to argue the speed camera may have been faulty or triggered by a car in the next lane. Our reporter Andrew Plant has been investigating.
He has an A4 folder 2 inches thick with 3 years of legal paperwork. Richard Keedwell's speeding case began with a standard fine which popped through the post back in 2016. Flashed doing 35 in a 30 by a camera in Worcester, but certain he'd been driving within the limit, his attempts to overturn the conviction have now cost him £30,000, including, he says, his son's inheritance too.
So the original fine was £100?
Would have been £100 and 3 penalty points, which is standard.
Why not just pay that?
I just thought that it needed airing. It should be taken to the court and we should prove it either way. It's cost this enormous fortune now and, well, it seems to have been a waste of time.
You've spent £30,000.
Must be that much, yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Terrible. I mean, I wake in the middle of the night in a cold sweat and have panic attacks.
Mr. Keedwell even recruited an expert to analyse the evidence, but his Crown Court appeal failed last month. He now says he regrets the losses, equivalent to more than 300 times the cost of the original ticket.
Andrew Plant reporting. Staying here in Britain, and domestic abuse charities and opposition politicians are calling for a former England cricketer, Geoffrey Boycott, to be stripped of his knighthood because of a domestic violence conviction. In 1998, Sir Geoffrey was convicted by a French court of beating up his then-girlfriend. Morgan Eyre gave us the details.
Lots of charities such as Women's Aid, Women's Trust, along with some politicians and celebrities, have all come out against Sir Geoffrey being knighted. I've seen on social media the hashtag boycott, boycott is one that they've come up with. For these charities, they've basically said that they're disappointed and would like the knighthood withdrawn. For them, it sends a very dangerous message, and the Women's Trust charity said that by knighting someone convicted of domestic abuse, you're sending one of two messages. Either he's famous, so domestic abuse doesn't matter, or two, you believe he didn't do it and you don't believe the victim and are disregarding them. For them, it's putting his sporting achievements above what women and men who are in abusive relationships, what they go through, and takes their value away. Now, it's important to note that Sir Geoffrey has always denied the allegations and he said he's innocent. And when asked by the BBC's Martha Carney what he thought about the criticism, this is what he had to say.
It's a cross I have to bear, right or wrong, good or bad. I have to live with it, and I do, because I'm clear in my mind, and I think most people in England are, that it's not true.
Although the chief executive of Women's Aid has said celebrating a man...
I don't care a toss about her, love. It's 25 years ago.
So he says it's not true. He appealed, but that appeal was rejected, of course. Some might argue he was punished. He should be allowed to move on from that.
Yeah, you're right. And I have seen comments on social media from people who said they support him as a cricket player. They say this knighthood was long overdue and they point to his charity work. Now, it is important to remember that this has gone through a system and a committee. So it has been a process. And he also does still work for the BBC as a cricket commentator. But for these women's charities, they're saying it's about being a role model, both on and off the pitch. And it isn't something which can just be overlooked and it should be taken away. But Theresa May has also been criticised for her role. And this is what Anthea Sully from the White Ribbon had to say.
Well, I think Theresa May's made a serious error of judgment. One of the things that she was pushing through as Prime Minister was to bring forward a new domestic abuse bill. And this seems to fly in the face of that.
Anthea Sully there from the charity White Ribbon, which works with men to prevent violence against women. Now, he's been praised for capturing the essence of ordinary people like no photographer before him. And now the celebrated artist Robert Frank has died in Canada at the age of 94. His major work, The Americans, was created during a road trip through the US, documenting everyday life across the states. Vincent Dowd, our arts correspondent, told me more about him.
Actually born in Zurich, but he came to the USA in 1947 when he was 22, 23, worked as a photographer here and there. But absolutely remarkably, after little more than a decade, he published a fantastic photographic book called, as you say, The Americans. It was originally actually published in France in 1958 with some very French essays, but the following year it came out in the USA, mainly without the words. It's a huge example of the importance of being in the right place at the right time in culture. It helped, of course, in the States, The Americans had a preface by Jack Kerouac, so it became the photo book of the Beat Generation. 83 black and white images of the almost 30,000 pictures he'd actually taken in a huge road trip across America. He documented the nation, which didn't normally get into the papers and magazines. It was the plain day-to-day America of luncheon counters and buses and people on slightly grubby streets. And yet he found a kind of beauty in it, which I think you still see. So he didn't give many interviews, but here's Robert Frank years later recalling that journey across America.
What a lonely time it can be in America, and what a tough country it is. And also, I saw for the first time the way blacks were treated. But it didn't make me hate America. It made me understand how people can be. You know, you learn a lot traveling. You learn a lot when you're a photographer. And if you have some brain and some feeling for people, you're going to be a good photographer.
I'm reading a quote from him here. It says, when people look at my pictures, I want them to feel the way they do when they want to read a line of a poem twice. You do want to look at his pictures again and again. What is his legacy?
Well, the late 50s, in retrospect, were that time the beginning of modern America, that prelude to the seismic changes, more obvious changes of the 1960s. So Robert Frank recorded America before civil rights really kicked in, before alternative culture grew. But he actually defined America at a time when it was changing, and culture is often at its strongest, its most memorable when it's changing, and he actually caught that beautifully. I don't think anybody is going to be able to take advantage of that kind of moment ever again.
Vincent Dowd. China may be a major player in the world economy, but up until now, it's been a minor player in the world of football. The Chinese team failed to score a single goal in its only appearance in the World Cup finals in 2002. But President Xi Jinping wants to change all that. And heading into the 2022 World Cup qualifying campaign, its squad contains, for the very first time, a naturalised citizen of non-Chinese heritage, the Brazilian-born striker Elkerson. James Kumarasamy spoke to Xiao Jijie from the BBC Chinese service about the new player switching up China's game.
Elkerson, originated from Brazil, is now the all-time top scorer in Chinese top flight Super League, and he has been playing in China as a foreign player for 6 years now and has won multiple trophies with the two clubs he's played for here. So quite evidently he sees no cultural or tactical barriers in terms of playing with Chinese players.
He's been playing as a foreigner, but now he's playing on the national team.
Yes, now he's playing in the national team. Just 2 months ago, he was still a Brazilian citizen, but in July, news reported that he has just obtained his Chinese passport.
How unusual is this?
Although it is an idea that China has been toying with over the years, they have never committed to it because China is just a country with a strong hand nationalist sense. So the idea of letting a foreigner play their football has been some kind of a Pandora box that they didn't want to open. However, China's football-loving President Xi Jinping has been saying that he wants China to become a football superpower. He wants China to be in the World Cup, to host the World Cup, and to eventually win the World Cup. That's his vision. But unfortunately, the reality now is that China have failed to qualify for any World Cup since 2002. And even for the under-20 World Cup, China have been unable to qualify since 2005. That generation of Chinese players are now well into their 30s and haven't won anything. The younger players are not even considered to be as good. So under that prospect, for Qatar 2022, maybe they just don't want to wait for another 10 years or so for the youth training system to bear fruit.
How controversial has the decision to play Elkerson in the national team been?
It wasn't exactly an easy decision. Just during this year's Chinese National Congress in March, there has been some debate about this particular issue. Chinese clubs were instructed somehow not to play any naturalized players in the first two rounds of the leagues. So you can see that they are trying to play this quite subtly.
Quite subtly, but that subtlety is going to go out the window if he comes on as striker for the national team in the first World Cup qualifier.
Yes, I mean, obviously, he's been getting quite a lot of attention since the call-up, but he's been living and playing in China for a while now. And for Elkerson, his main job here is to score goals, and he's been doing that in abundance in the past few years in China. So he's very much loved by the Chinese fans, but we still need to see how it turns out when he's, you know, wearing a Chinese jersey.
The process of becoming a naturalized citizen, how difficult is it? And was it fast-tracked for him?
In terms of the Chinese law, the Chinese nationality law doesn't really list out all the details. But the key thing in here is that for anyone to obtain a Chinese citizenship is that you have to give up your original passport, because Chinese nationality law simply allows no dual citizenship. Also, as a football player, apart from getting the citizenship, you also have to comply with a few FIFA rules. You either have a Chinese parent or grandparent, or you have lived in the country for at least 5 years. Meanwhile, China Football Association has also made it clear that anyone in the national team must be able to sing the national anthem in Mandarin. So for people like Elkerson, that might be even bigger challenge than scoring goals on the pitch.
Xiao Jijie there from the BBC Chinese service. Finally, buckle up, because we're about to take you back in time, 66 million years ago to be exact, to the very day an asteroid hit the Earth and wiped out the dinosaurs. Using a newly discovered rock sample, scientists are piecing together the most detailed picture yet of that day, and also what followed, a decades-long winter. I spoke to Professor Sean Gulick from the University of Texas in Austin, who led the project.
The first rocks we pulled up were about 48 million years old, and we just kept drilling down until we reached the impact, which of course is 66 million years old. And it turned out we were able to pull up about 130 meters of rock burying a ring of mountains that surrounds the center of the crater. And all of those 130 meters that happened right above that this peak ring, we now think were actually formed within the first day after the impact.
So studying this rock, what does it tell us about what happened directly after the impact?
Well, sure. It allows us to sort of read a book of what happened from the moment of the impact through the end of the first day. At the very bottom of this pile of 130 meters, we have melted rock caused by the pressures of the impact. And then fantastically, at the very top of this whole pile, we found evidence of seiches, like waves in a bathtub that had gone back and forth in the crater. And then above that, we actually found the tsunami layer itself. So a tsunami that would have left the crater upon the initial impact, gone all the way, maybe 800 kilometers away to the shoreline in central Mexico, bounced back. But then the other thing we discovered was a complete lack of the sulfur-rich rocks that we would have expected to find within the crater, and very much supports this model that sulfur would have been released at very large volumes into the atmosphere, combining with water vapor to become sulfate aerosols, which of course block the sunlight and would cause first darkness and loss of photosynthesis, but then even after that would cause a global cooling event of perhaps 25 degrees C or more over the entire planet.
So it's what you didn't find as much as what you did find that told you the lack of sulfur, told you what happened, and that was it for the dinosaurs. That, so, tell me, can you work out how long it took them to die as a result of that?
Well, certainly if you were a large land dinosaur, you could expect that some of them anyway might have died from the fires and the incoming fast ejecta. But, you know, many of them would have made it. And in fact, all our modern birds are descendants of the dinosaurs that did make it.
And the planet, if dinosaurs had still roamed, if that had never happened, do you ever envisage that in your mind's eye?
You know, things were going okay for the dinosaurs. They'd been around a couple hundred million years, and I think it did take a pretty calamitous event to completely change the climate like that and result in a complete changeover of the course of life on Earth.
Professor Sean Gullick there from the University of Texas. And that is all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can. Just send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Claire McDonnell, and until next time, goodbye.